This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. During the recent Magic Live convention in Las Vegas, I stayed over for an additional day to get a couple of exclusive interviews. This is one of them. Today, we travel to the home of Lupe and Norm Nielsen. Norm is well known as a performer, collector, and builder, and certainly Lupe is an excellent professional performer and builder herself. When I asked Lupe during the convention if I could schedule a time to come over for a visit, she told me that it'd be fine, but there'd be nothing to see because the bulk of Norm's collection has been shipped to Chicago in preparation for the Potter & Potter sale next year. Well, I thought that is all the more reason to speak with Norm about why he is selling his collection, as well as to talk about how he began acquiring the posters. I also wanted to talk with him about his illustrious career and hear some stories about his travels. In order to get to his home, I needed a ride from the Orleans Casino and Hotel where I was staying for the convention. David Sandy and Lance Rich were kind enough to provide transportation with the allure of seeing some of Norm's remaining posters and hearing some great stories live. As a bonus to this podcast, David shared a funny story about Fawcett Ross that Mac King says is his favorite story. This was alluded to during one of the Magic Live updates, and I hoped to corner David to have him tell it during the course of the convention. But, alas, with so many people at the convention, our paths didn't cross to make that happen. So, it seemed that I should capture it now or never. So, after we hear from Lupe and Norm in this podcast, stay tuned for a few more minutes to listen to David's true tale, all here on The Magic Word. Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com, and I've got a special treat for listeners and for me, too. We're here in the home of Norm Nielsen. Hello there, Norm.
Norm and Lupe.
And I was going to say, and Lupe also, because also we have with us, yep, Lupe Nielsen, and also...
And Misty.
And Misty the dog, that's right.
You're the greeter.
I was going to say, it's not an attack dog, it's just the greeter dog.
Right.
And then I've got Lance and also David Sandy. Thank you guys for the ride over here. And I mentioned that because all these people who are going to be in the background might have some questions or something to kind of throw in here then too, or comments as we start to go through this. So... I think you guys will all be able to hear kind of what's going on. And the main thing, I mean, there are a lot of things that I want to talk about, but mm-hmm. as I understand it, that I was, I guess, maybe one of the last to know, I was kind of surprised that your magic collection of posters is going to be up for auction by Potter & Potter.
Yes, a lot of them will be up for auction. Some are sold already. David Copperfield came over and he picked a few that he didn't have, so yeah. That was nice. And a few others, a couple of others came over. So it'll be interesting to see how it goes in Potter & Potter. They're doing so well with the
yes.
things they do.
And you said there were going to be two separate auctions?
We expect that, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a lot.
At this point, that how you ship most of the things or all of your...
Yes, there okay. was a semi here to pick them all up, and off they went.
Yeah, well, I was listening to Mike Caveney's lecture when he went to the Egyptian Hall, and he said that when he picked up all these posters, there were 5 tons of posters.
Yeah, yeah.
So how much did you guys have?
What were there, 700 posters?
800 posters.
Oh, 804.
804 posters. Now, when you're talking posters, some of those are 8 sheets and everything then, too.
Yes.
And
yeah.
some were framed and some were not.
Oh, so the frames are going with it
oh, yeah.
then as well.
Yeah.
Because some of the frames, I guess, that you had them mounted such that they couldn't be taken out of the frames then?
Oh, or? Yeah. Most mm-hmm. of them could be taken out. Most of them could.
Okay.
But some were probably in the frame, not having been mounted, you know.
How did you decide which ones you were going to let go?
You know, they wanted the whole collection.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Lupe pulled them all together.
Yeah, it pulled them out. 804 posters, and then we sold 80 to about a few private collectors, and we still have over 1,000 posters left.
That you're not going to be selling here.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So we decided to keep all the ones that you see in the living room so that it wouldn't be a shock.
Yeah, boy, talk about cold turkey. If you kind of move these out, you'd think, oh, gosh,
exactly.
I need
yeah.
to move.
Yeah. So it was funny. The yeah. Chinese that you see in the back, the 3 sheet.
Yes.
We sold the original to a collector who was hounding us for years
yeah.
that he wanted that poster. So we said, well, we basically, the very first people that cherry pick, they pay confiscatory rates, and practically were extorted in the prices. But they got those beautiful posters. That's a one-of-a-kind poster.
Yeah, that's it.
And Norm was missing that poster so much that he made a reproduction. So what you see on the wall there.
That's a reproduction.
That's a reproduction.
Yeah.
Are you going to sell, or did you make more reproductions, or is that just a one-off?
I would only make them as somebody wanted them, or if I needed one. Yeah.
Okay, so you do have that you could make another if you wanted.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I'll make sure to take a picture of that and put that on the blog too.
And then there's that Germaine, so the piece that was next to it was an Ionia.
Oh, yeah.
That it was three sheet, that there's probably like two in the world.
Beautiful.
And sold that, but then we wanted to replace that space. So we kept posters that are not necessarily the most rare ones. They're beautiful nevertheless. So that Germaine the Wizard.
And that Cardini over there is a collage of his billiard balls being punched through the poster, and the fan of cards.
Oh, I see, sure.
His cards, and the watch around his wrist, and the cigarette, and so forth. It wasn't his cigarette, though.
Is that a poster that you have made the collage like of the others?
There was a 8x10 I had of Cardini holding the fan.
Okay.
And so I just blew it up.
Well, let me go back in history. Now, of course, I had recorded your speech you did for the IBM. Was it last year, I think, or for the combined couple of years ago? Yeah, Lupe. It was beautiful. It showed all the slides of a lot of the posters and talked about this. And so for those who want to go back, then just do a search on the blog here for Lupe Nielsen, and then you can go back and listen to that. It was fabulous, and thanks for letting me record that and pass it on. But just to keep it kind of the context of this, just going back, what was your first poster that you had received?
First poster was given to me by Mike, what was his name, Lupe?
Victor King.
It was a Fu Manchu poster, just a half-sheet poster from Mexico with the dancing girls on it. And it was in pieces. So the next day he came again and get me a little bit better one. And I knew nothing about posters then. I was living in L.A., and I laid it all out and started piecing it all together and making a poster out of it.
Yeah.
And I was just, hey, that worked out pretty good.
Had a shop where you were already making things because you had worked with Okito, is that right?
Yeah. I had Okito's tools and still use them.
Yeah, still use some of the same tools.
Yeah. And some out in the museum, I have a frame where I put some of the tools in there so they would be kept intact,
Okay. We'll get to that here pretty soon then, too. But so that excited you enough that you wanted to get another poster, and then whenever you get two or three of anything, it's like, okay, now I've got a collection.
Yeah, well, that's what happened. I put that one up, and see, I like that. It was in my office in L.A., and then I went to Mario Carandi.
Yeah.
He was at the Kansas City convention quite a number of years ago, and he had a poster of Fraxin, Senor Fraxin. I knew Fraxin. I just loved the guy, We were a good pal. I remember when I first worked in Madrid, and I walked out on the stage, a 10 o'clock show at night, because it was always late, and who do I see in the audience?
Fraxin sitting in the audience.
Fraxin sitting in the audience. And they say he never went out at night.
Yeah.
So that really meant a lot to me. And then we hung out together. We went places. And we had a great time. We became really good pals.
Did you work with him in some of the nightclubs there?
No, he didn't. He started doing a few shows after I got there. He says it kind of
inspired him to
go
back on.
Yeah.
Okay.
Do things again. Oh, we just had a great time. We had good rapport, like with Theo Bamberg, too, Okito.
Yeah.
I was at a J. Marshall's, and there was a group of magicians there from Chicago, and I met a few of them, and this little old man came up to me and shook my hand, gave me his card. He says, come see me sometime, and it was Theo Bamberg. My mouth just dropped open,
What year would this have been, approximately?
Oh, probably about 63, maybe.
Okay.
About.
Yeah.
Maybe a little earlier than that. And so I went to Chicago and met Theo, and we spent the whole day together. And that we repeated a number of times over the next 2 years. And I made The first trick I made of his was the triangular mystery, which sets... No, it's not there now. Okay. Oh, yeah, it's in the back of the card star.
Behind the card star, mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm.
And I made that, and by the time I had finished that, Theo was in a nursing home, and I went to see him in Chicago, and I was carrying this inside, you know, mm-hmm. into the room. And he sat up in bed immediately. He said, where did you get that? And he examined the thing. See how straight the wood was? What did you use for wood? And what kind of paint did you use? It was just a kick. I remember the whole day, you know. It was just...
Wow. That had to be thrilling. Sure. Yeah. Now, did you have an interest in woodworking before? I mean...
At that time, I was taking woodworking in school. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In high school or college?
No, it was a night school.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah. And you didn't have probably many tools at that time either.
No,
it was a poor student.
He says, don't buy any tools. I want to go with you.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. We went to Sears. We got a few things.
Yeah. He suggested you need to have this,
and
this.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I got some of his tools.
Yeah.
I remember once I was in his room, and we were talking, and there was an old trunk on the end of his bed.
Mm-hmm.
I said, Theo, what's in that trunk? I was really curious, you know.
Sure.
He says, he brightened up, my tools. And he opened up the trunk and he started taking out each tool and describing just how he used it.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it was fascinating.
And so, those are some of the tools that are in your museum now that you have.
Absolutely.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And you use those, though, for the longest time yourself?
Yeah, I still have some in the workshop I use all the time.
Right.
You know, like the straight edge, I wouldn't be without that.
Wow. Now, like the box up there and some of the others, those were before stencils, or they're hand-painted as far as the designs on the side?
No, nothing's hand-painted. That's what I found out from him. He bought these German decals.
Mm-hmm.
They were varnish type decals. You apply them with varnish.
Yeah.
And he showed me how to use them, how to apply them, and so forth. And where
without
to get
getting
them.
Any bubbles in it and all that kind of
thing.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah, all very out, sure. Important how to put them down. And he got them from a place. They're from Germany, but there was a place in New York called Wells Company. And he gave me the address and all that, and I wrote to them.
No relation to me.
No.
And so you had worked with him, and you built some things that he used in his act then, or?
The first thing I built was a triangular mystery, you know, with the three panels that lie against the easel.
Right.
And you put it together. That's the one I showed him. That's what he looked at, examined it so carefully. Must have been 20 minutes, you know.
Wow, gosh.
Yeah. Okay. And then looked up at me and says, it's good.
Gave you his approval.
Yeah. He says, you can make anything I ever made.
Now, his picture hangs on above the fireplace of the Magic Castle. Isn't that Okito, David? Do you know? There's a picture. I thought that was Okito. Lance, do you know?
Yeah. That's Okito there, too.
Yes, above your fireplace, right here, in fact. It's big. That's a, what's the size of it? Is that a 4-sheet?
That's about a 4-sheet, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. And just so people know what the difference is between 2, 3, 4, and 8 sheets, what does that mean?
Well, a 1 sheet is about 30 inches by 40 inches. So a half sheet is about half that much, and so on and so forth.
Yes.
Little variations, you know.
Yeah. And I have found that those 8-sheet posters are cheaper because they're so large that most people can't display them.
Exactly.
And so,
exactly, yeah.
Yeah, they were actually made... Well, like all of them were made really to promote the shows.
Yeah, to go on the side of a building or on a billboard or whatever.
Right, and then they just pasted over it with the next show,
exactly.
Whatever's coming through town.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Otis was one of the stone lithographers, and who
that's,
else?
That's one that that Thurston used a lot.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think he put money into the Otis. And the outstanding one, let's see if I can remember the name now. Sorry, age is... kind of hovers over me.
It's okay. Thank you, Lupe. You bring some coffee and cookies. Oh, my gosh. Thanks.
Oh,
well, and also, like with the stone lithographs, that it's actually pressed into the paper, like with the stone, so that it's, I mean, you could take a loop and look through that to see the difference.
Yeah, there would be like, they would use these 30 by 40 inch stones, maybe 2.5 inches thick, and they'd polish them. Polish them really well, and then they put an image on there.
Thank you so very much.
Yeah.
You get the David Copperfield mug.
Oh, boy.
Oh, I'm special. Thank you. Wow, that is cool. Oh, Butchie's. I like that.
That's a Butchie's.
That's from his place, yeah.
I'd love to go to his museum. That's one place I've not been yet. On my bucket list.
You have to, yeah. Oh, that's incredible. Absolutely.
And so I'm sure he has some HE posters that are displayed. He's got room in there.
Yeah.
To have that. What would you say is one of his most prized posters that he has collected, which probably came from you but or Jay Marshall? But
some of them did, but I haven't been up there for quite a long time. What stands out to you, Loop?
What is that?
The posters that David has. It's just an incredible collection.
It's what everybody tells me.
Yeah, oh, something you have to see.
He has everything. He collects collections.
Yeah. Yeah, I know he had a deal with Jay Marshall, I guess, to get most of his stuff after he had left. And
well, that was an interesting story. I was there at David's, and Jay Marshall called.
No, black's fine, thank you.
Yeah, and Jay Marshall called, and David talked to him for a while, and he says he wants to talk to you. So I got on the phone, and we made arrangements for me to go and see his posters in Chicago. And that's how that's all started, you know.
Well, as I remember in visiting Jay's catacombs of all those, that he had all those posters just kind of literally like underground and back tucked away. They didn't have them all displayed by any means.
Oh, no, not at all. Mm-hmm. No,
he just collected it to be collecting.
Yeah, he just loved to collect them. And I remember the first time I went to Jay's, I was with Marshall Brodeen, and we looked through the posters. That's what really got under my skin. You know?
Oh, by seeing all that, your mouth started to water.
It did. It really did.
Uh-huh.
And that's one thing led to another, you know.
And did you start buying some or trading?
Yeah.
Most collectors actually trade rather than buying outright, don't they?
Both ways. First poster was given to me by, as we mentioned, you know, the one of Fu Manchu.
Yes.
And I put that up, and I just liked it a lot. And then I went to the Kansas City convention years ago. Mario Carandi had posters there, and he had one of, as I mentioned, I think, Fraxin, and another one, a three-sheet Carter poster. And I was just salivating, you know, it was just incredible. How much would those two be? And he told me, I think it was like $1,500. Oh my God. And I bought them.
Yeah.
That was the beginning. And there was no turning back after that. Then any convention I went to, I looked for them.
One of the things I think with art in general is that you should buy what you like.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
What you love. You don't buy it for an investment purpose. And that was not your intention, was it?
Not at all. I never imagined selling any of them.
Yeah.
Unless I bought them.
Well, but you've enjoyed them for so long. I guess, am I putting words in your mouth? What's your reason for actually disposing
of
them?
Well, you know, I'm 81 years old.
Okay.
And I think
81 years young.
Well, whatever.
We're all getting closer up there.
Doesn't matter either way.
Yeah.
Anyway, I was just ready. I think it's time to start selling. I don't know.
Because you've been collecting for so many years and acquiring all of these.
Yeah, and I still have a lot of posters. Yeah. So.
And as Lupe said, that you had kept, how many did you say? Did you still have? That you
were 1,000 posters.
Still here then. At a little at a time, I assume, over the next 20 years or so, that you'll start disposing of some more incrementally.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Some person came to the convention and he says, do you have Houdini posters? And we said, yeah. but is he prepared to pay what a Houdini poster is worth? So if we told him about the posters and next year's auctions. And we kept a few Houdinis because you don't want to flood the auctions with
that's a very good point.
Extremely high-end posters.
Right.
Because the market is very tiny. So we're giving the auctioneer probably like 8 Houdini pieces. And the 3 of them are very high-end.
Right.
Over the $50,000 range.
Wise from a marketing standpoint, because I'm thinking back about, let's say, baseball cards. There have been a rise and fall in those, or anything for that matter, sometimes that things have a certain higher value than later. I mean, now that these baseball card conventions, I think they're practically having to give away, you know, some of the stuff. But it used to be that they were going for hundreds or thousands of dollars. And I don't know whether that just people are getting older who are the collectors, or maybe they don't have as much disposable income to do that, or whatever reason. Posters also certainly started rising. And as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, that it was after Mike Caveney and his what's the fellow who was with him that bought the posters?
George Daly.
Yeah, George Daly.
Right.
Bought the poster collection, mm-hmm. and they started selling them. But they were the ones who kind of set the prices.
I think they did.
Because how much is that worth? Let's say $10,000 and see how it goes.
Yeah. Well, you don't know.
You don't.
No, actually, I don't think they set the prices. What was setting the prices in the late 90s was that the economy was very affluent at that time.
Yeah.
And most of the auctions, when you went to auctions, there were a few people that were just going crazy about this paper, and the prices were very high. But after 9/11 hit, and we had a recession, then the price in collectibles above the, everything, of all collectibles went down mm-hmm. because of the uncertainty of the
market. The fear, sure, exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So things started coming back up probably, I guess, of 2006. But currently with the economy as it is now, people have less disposable income. So we don't know how they're going to be.
Right. Scott,
yes, David.
Question from the studio audience over here on the sofa.
Please, yeah.
You know, I'm sitting here in midst of this beautiful collection in just this living room of all of these great posters, and you mentioned earlier that these posters are truly works of art, and that's indisputable. I'm just curious, in the when these performers would have these posters created, mm-hmm. like you have a lot of Chung Ling Su here in this particular room, was it the same artist that created a lot of the same posters for a performer, or were there multiple artists with a performer? How did this process happen for these?
Apparently, the artist wasn't all that important, except for some reason or other, because we don't even know the artist's names, except maybe a couple of them. And then as the printer, like Friedlander in Germany, they printed them, and that was what was important, because there's a different artist for each color.
A different artist for each color?
For each color, yeah. Huh. There'd be maybe six artists. One would do blue, one would do red, one would do yellow, and so forth.
Really?
Wow. Now, it's interesting you ask that question, because I was going to lead to that, because I was going to ask about whether it's true that I've heard that that Chung Ling Su had asked students make posters. And
right.
Yes?
That's why there's such a variety of Su posters.
Yeah.
There's
you want to tell the story?
80 or 90 different posters still out there, still around. There were more than that altogether, mm-hmm. different ones,
Okay.
And some are really terrific.
Tell the story, again, what he did, or how that he had...
Chung Ling Su,
he
would have an art contest, and give him whoever won, he'd get a couple tickets to the show.
In the city he was going to be playing, he would have the art contest.
Right, yeah. So,
and if he liked them, then he would commission it, and then he would take it to the printer, I guess.
That's why his are so different, one from the other. Mm-hmm. They're all done by different, not all of them, naturally, but many of them are different artists.
Good question, though.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Well, I see the vibrance of the colors and things like that, at the LA History Conference this past, mm-hmm. the past year, we went to this printing company as a part of the experience, mm-hmm. and we saw the old printing processes and mm-hmm. for mm-hmm. posters and stuff, and I just find that very interesting.
Well, fascinating, yeah.
The mm-hmm. technology has taken into sometimes if you don't think about that, you don't appreciate the process that goes
right.
into the creation of these
It
posters.
Gets lost along the way.
So how long it took to create one.
Yeah, exactly. You have an artist that starts with an idea, but then there's different artists that do different colors in the post.
And then the way they lay on the colors, and
that's
then have
right.
to press another color on
that's
top of
right.
that, and then have the trademark
the
to make sure that it's going to be registered properly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Are there telltale signs to see if it was a stone lithograph or
you can take a loop mm-hmm. magnifying glass and look, and you can see the dots, mm-hmm. individual dots.
For stone.
Yeah,
for stone
it's going to be flat.
No.
Yeah, is that right?
No, stone
you
can see.
A haphazard pattern is mostly a stone, mm-hmm. but you have to remember that in the, 1920s, they started doing the offset printing with plates.
Yeah.
So
okay.
there are some Su posters where the portrait area
yeah.
uh-huh. is half dome, mm-hmm. and the background is made out of a stone litho. With limestone. So
it would be combined, the two,
could be
the two
combined
methods
well.
Would be combined.
That's interesting.
Yeah, yeah, a few of them.
Okay.
Now, Mike Caveney mentioned in his talk, he had one that was wood. That was a
woodcut, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah.
We have a few of those.
And that they would have a different woodcut for each color that they would put on
right,
there, too.
A different block of wood for mm-hmm. each color, yeah.
And I guess that goes back to having a different artist for each block that they're mm-hmm. having in, too. Mm-hmm. Fascinating.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it is.
I guess I should ask the obligatory question that you are always asked about what is your favorite, and it's like your children, of course. It's hard to choose
yeah.
a favorite.
Right.
But obviously these in here must be your favorite because you live with these all the time.
Probably
but the one
that
hanging
one
over
is
the fireplace.
Big favorite, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okito, the original Chinese magician.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Again, because he has such a closeness to your heart, I'm sure.
Exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, had met him the way I did, and, you know, I just did a little show in Chicago for the ring.
Yeah.
And then he came up to me and shook my hand and introduced himself.
How was your performance influenced by him?
I don't know. I was amazed that he was even interested after my performance.
Yeah.
I was just out of Chavez school.
Yeah.
We're doing a few shows between Chicago and Milwaukee, you know, in Kenosha. And that was all.
But I just wonder if there were some things, perhaps, that were some presentational styles or something he may have taught
know.
You or you may have learned.
Oh, from Theo?
Yes.
Not really.
Okay.
Yeah.
And developing, like, your violin and floating in the musical kind of an act that you had.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
Oh, let's see. Oh, I guess I wanted to put something together that made some sense. I was working in L.A. doing club dates, and I just got the idea. You know, I love music, but I couldn't play anything. So I thought, oh, man, I love a violin. God, that just intrigued me. So when I was doing the zombie, mm-hmm. the big one, and playing with that, I thought, oh, that's how it started.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, put something else on there and float it. And it was a violin.
Made sense since, yeah.
Yeah, and it took a year to develop it. I remember the first time I tried it, I was working at the Playboy Club in Los Angeles. And the last show I did, you know, during that month or 2 weeks, whatever it was late at night, and I had been playing with the violin and so forth, and I put it in. There was no music to it. Completely silent, but I just wanted to do it. I just was drawn to it. And after I finished, complete silence. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh my God, I got to scrap this one.
Yeah, they didn't like it.
Well, they didn't know how to react.
Yeah.
There was no music, you know.
Yeah.
Didn't build up. And then I played with it, rehearsed it for about 6 months after that. Mm-hmm. And then I broke it in. Then it was working better. And then I was living in Kenosha, Wisconsin, which was my hometown, and I heard that somebody on the corner of the street where I was living was a violinist from Turkey. He was the first violinist in the Turkish orchestra.
Hmm.
I went knocking on his door. I said, I do this thing with a floating violin. He says, yeah. Well, he says, here, we got some people coming over tonight. You go out and do it, and I'll be in the other room, and I'll play something. And that's what he did.
Hmm.
And it was really eerie, the thing. It was kind of like a lament, mother with her dying son, something like that. It was so sad, you know.
Very depressing. Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. But I used that for quite a long time. And then I got another piece by a French.
Well, then at the end that you have a comical piece where that the violin comes out and takes a bow and all that. How did that come about?
Let's see. I just say something just triggered. You know, the idea was I have a quartet come out, you know, a bass and a violin and a cello or whatever. And I thought, oh, that's too complicated, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So I thought, just the violin.
Yeah, since it was the star of the show and floating already,
yeah,
so
yeah,
well, yeah.
Yeah,
okay.
That made sense.
Right.
And then, of course, you got to make it disappear.
Yeah.
And then it comes back. So it
and when
sense.
You when you exactly so it's full circle. But when you create these things, is it something that you put together like a little model first of all to see how it's going to work?
Oh,
you draw it out, or how do you?
Yeah, I must have made four or five violins before I had one that I was happy with.
Yeah.
You know, Yeah.
See, I'm thinking back like Walter Blaney had his ladder levitation. Yeah. He had a little doll, right. Little Barbie doll thing. And uh-huh. It was that size, you know, that he kind of fiddled around, make sure it's all sure. going to work before he start building the larger one, you
exactly.
know.
Exactly.
kind of
yeah.
a thing.
Yeah.
Well, the first time that I saw you perform was actually on a movie, Bobby Deerfield.
Oh, yeah.
You know, with Al Pacino. I don't know uh-huh. how long ago that was. And I thought, well, that is I must have played that scene over and over. when it came on videotape then later, that I just thought it was interesting. How did you get connected with the movie? You happened to be in the city.
I was in Paris working at the Crazy Horse Saloon.
Mm-hmm.
Really an odd situation. I never went to the Crazy Horse during the day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we weren't really, they didn't want us to because they had the girls rehearsing and so forth.
Right.
And why was I? Oh, I was looking for, I was expecting a contract from Germany. So I stopped in there one day in the afternoon, you know.
Yeah. And on a fluke, just stopped in.
Just on a complete fluke. And I'm walking away. I got to the contract or whatever and walking down the street on the George Sank. And the secretary comes out hollering, "Norm, you got a letter or you got a phone call." Mm-hmm. I said, "What? How could I have a phone call? I never even go there."
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I pick up the phone, and it's Chapelier, casting director.
Casting director, okay.
Yeah. And she says, "Sidney Pollack was in to see you the other night, and he'd like to see you, you know." Mm-hmm. So I says, "Okay, when can I come in? Can you come today?" I says, "I'll be right there." I was so excited.
Yeah.
And that was a great pleasure. He was a marvel, Sidney Pollack, when he would describe something or whatever.
Uh-huh.
You just, oh, my God. You know.
How many takes did you have to do?
Two.
Oh, was that all?
Yeah.
Interesting.
He says, "Where would you like to do it? We'll set up a little booth for you here, and you can... you know, be right next to where you're going to be performing."
And as I recall, it was in a bar scene, and Al Pacino was sitting there, too, then?
Yeah.
Did you get interacted with him at all? Because yours was a silent piece that he was doing. It seemed like it was a very, kind of a melancholy scene, as I recall.
Yeah. I think I said two words. You know, he says, what was it? Would you like a drink, or what are you drinking? Oh, I had to do it. I did it in German. Ein Whisky bitte. So that's why you didn't hear it.
Okay.
And they were surprised I could say that, you know.
Uh-huh. Well, how many languages do you speak?
Oh, no, I don't.
None?
Except English. I can't even speak English very well.
Were you in another movies aside from that?
No.
Nothing?
No, that, no, was, that was,
that was
the one.
That was interesting.
Right after I did that and it was playing, they called me up and they wanted me to try out for another where I'd be a soldier, a young soldier or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't do it. I was going to Spain.
Yeah.
So I was just occupied. I couldn't do it.
Yeah. Well, going back to the Crazy Horse then, how long were you performing there and how did that all come about?
Let's see. How did I get... It was really... I can't remember exactly now.
That's the audition that you did for...
Oh, for the movie.
For Letty.
Oh, for Mark Letty. That's right.
He was the Ed Sullivan guy.
Yeah. That's right. Uh-huh. That was fascinating, yeah, to go to the Crazy Horse. And I was in awe. I mean, it's such a little... Have you ever been there?
I've not.
It's such a little room. Mm-hmm. What is it, about this size?
Wow, is that right?
You know, and then the stage on one end. And
how many people is a seat?
150, maybe.
Wow,
maybe,
okay.
I'm guessing.
About the size of Magic Island, I guess.
Yeah,
which, you know,
really
kind of
small
showroom.
Hmm. Yeah.
But you just worked there for a while, and then, I mean, that's a solid thing.
I worked
thing.
There 7 years.
Wow, over, okay.
You know, mm-hmm. sometimes only 1 month or sometimes 5 months in that year.
Mm-hmm.
But because there was a tax regulation for the states, you couldn't work over 6 months. In a foreign country and still deduct the taxes.
Just for work visa problem issues,
yeah.
You mean?
Not a visa problem. It was for taxes.
Oh, I see.
And the fact that I was working there, I could pay the taxes in France and not pay them in the States on the same money.
Right.
You know?
Well, you weren't the first magician, I guess, to work at the Crazy Horse, though, were you?
Oh, no. There was a French magician that worked there. I can't think of his name now.
Do you remember his material?
Cards.
Cards.
He did cards. But, and I wonder...
I know since then they've had, Finn John, Kevin James.
There, yeah.
And,
right. And Mullica, Tom Mullica.
Tom Mullica was there for a long time.
Worked there. He wasn't there a long time.
He wasn't there one time?
A long time.
Oh, a long time. Okay. Yeah. And so latex and the doves and the bottles and things, how did that come about?
Oh.
Is that something that was actually part of your show? Or
no.
You needed a dove,
right.
I guess? Or?
It was. I was doing a vanishing bottle with a paper bag, a Weller bottle.
Yeah.
And then where did I first see the vinyl thing?
I don't remember.
And I went and I looked in L.A. for a place that could make vinyl. I said, yeah, we can do that. So that's how it started. They made I got a mold made and they tried it. That's not bad. A little thinner, a little bit too thick, you know, and so forth. That's how it started.
And so they were making them for you.
Yeah.
And then you started making them.
I never actually made the bottle.
Okay.
They made the molds.
Yeah, because they needed
heat,
heat equipment, so forth, mm-hmm. to cure the bottle, you know.
But then that evolved to the doves?
Yeah.
Which you do make here.
But the doves
I do make the doves.
You made those with Johnny Thompson.
Yeah, that's right. Johnny helped me do that. Uh-huh. Yeah. He knew how to make molds and so forth, so we laid that out and set that up, and we did that together, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Scott, interestingly enough, talking about the posters as collectibles, the Nielsen Heinz ketchup bottle has mm-hmm. become quite collectible now.
Oh, really?
Because it's not made anymore in the Heinz.
There is no Heinz ketchup.
Now it's Hunt's, isn't it?
Yeah, there was a Hunt's.
But
I just make it.
Originally Heinz.
I couldn't use it. I couldn't. It was supposed to be. But they wouldn't let me do it.
Oh, that's after. What happened was that Heinz wanted to do another contract. And their requirement to allow us to make the bottles
got
to
cost.
Was that we had to have a $5 million liability insurance.
Yeah.
So I called the insurance agent, and they said, well, that's about $24,000 a year.
Wow.
Yeah.
And with the fact that as a mom-and-pop business, we only sold probably 300 bottles a year.
Wouldn't work.
It wasn't worth it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To pay such a high insurance.
Thank goodness.
Yeah,
the way it worked out.
That was about 8 years ago. And then Norm and I thought, well, Heinz is already moving into the plastic bottles, the squeezable bottles.
Right.
And those glass bottles, you only see them in restaurants. You don't see them too often. So why go through the expense and the time of doing a huge liability insurance for a bottle that is being discontinued by the main company? So what we decided to do was, okay, let's make a generic one for those diehard people that want ketchups. And eventually that'll vanish, you know. Because it's generic, you know.
Right.
But we're surprised that the sales of that generic bottle are okay.
Sure.
I mean, it hasn't... we still make a generic bottle.
I don't understand the liability insurance portion that they were requiring.
In case a baby swallows a bottle or...
Wow.
Something.
Okay.
Insurance.
Yeah, you know, the litigious society in which we live.
That's true.
Be sued
that's
for
true.
$1 million.
Yeah. But they see the name Heinz on the bottle.
They would blame.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, sure.
Okay, that makes sense
right.
now.
Exactly.
But was the bottle,
the shape
unique to them?
Yeah.
That's why I was wondering. Okay.
The shape is trademarked.
So we changed it.
Yeah.
Bit.
Yeah.
And so you still have a ketchup bottle, but now
it's a generic bottle.
Generic bottle. Tomato ketchup.
And as a tip to people out there, our generic bottle, you can get it. And then there's somebody on eBay bootlegging.
Oh, yeah.
Heinz.
From China?
China, that's what I was going to ask.
I don't know who that person is.
Yeah.
But it seems that they can buy a generic bottle from us, and then if they go on eBay, they could probably find some Heinz ketchup labels.
Huh.
For that trick. But we cannot make them anymore, and we just don't.
No,
so
no.
The regular ketchup you're making, which, by the way, I'm always confused whether it's catsup, C-A-T-S-U-P, or is it ketchup, K-E-T.
Yeah,
yeah.
Is that a Heinz thing? Ketchups with that spelling? Is that trademark by Heinz?
I don't know. It is. I do not know where the word ketchup came from. Might be an interesting thing to Google.
That's right.
A whole other podcast.
That's a
podcast.
Do the research on that.
Yeah, the research is it catsup, C-A-T-S-U-P, or ketchup, K-E-T-S-U-P.
Yeah. But as for the doves, and so you still sell about, 300 bottles a year of that currently?
Of the ketchup, probably less than that.
Okay.
But we're it's amazing that it still sells, even if it's generic. we just did that bottle as a transition, you know, from the ketchups to the, mm-hmm. the Heinz, and then tell people we don't make any Heinz, but you can still get a generic, and they yeah. do,
right.
you know.
Well, did you have the same issue with, weren't you using Heineken bottles, beer bottles or something?
Heineken never gave us permission.
No, well, I wrote
Heineken
to them.
Heineken is one of the companies that they are highly protective of their trademark.
Kieran was fine.
Kieran was Kieran, fine.
They were
so, in Budweiser's, the permission we got was in those days when a handshake
yeah.
was sufficient, when you don't involve a legal department. So we had an agreement with the marketing department at Anheuser-Busch that was hiring probably 50 magicians to do trade shows all over the country.
Right.
You know, they use a lot of magicians. So it was a, you know, handshake with somebody in marketing that sent those labels and here are the caps, and, you know, make Budweiser. But then Budweiser was purchased by a company in Europe.
Yes.
It's no longer an American company.
I was just talking to someone this week, in fact, who was working with Anheuser-Busch, and I said, weren't you bought out by Germany? He said, well, actually, it's a Brazilian company that owns them now.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, yeah. I think it was a Stella Artois company from Belgium that bought it.
Yeah.
Now probably Brazil bought it.
Yeah.
So what has happened is that as soon as they bought everything to put all their donkeys in a row, they decided, okay, put legal and clean this up. Mm-hmm. And once legal got in, all the handshakes and wink-wink things under the table were off.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
But then a few years back, somebody in the marketing department at Coors, which makes Miller, sent us a letter saying that one of their magicians wanted to use a Miller bottle. So they sent those labels for Millers and caps for Millers. So, okay, it's the same shape, the bottle, so we'll just do the Miller. But it is tricky. Once you get the legals, you know, to do things, it gets so complicated paperwork-wise.
They want to control it.
I'm sure. Well, speaking of paper and paperwork, I guess, that when they do send you the labels, that those are paper, and that's the one thing that's kind of expendable, because when you're crushing the bottle and throwing it away, after a while that the label gets crinkled.
Yeah,
so
we print
Mylar, isn't it?
Yeah, no, a vinyl.
Vinyl.
Okay. I was noticing at FISM this year that there was someone selling bottles, and they had some sort of, it wasn't vinyl, but it was kind of a web kind of material or something, so when you crush it and open it back up, it still kept the same, retained it,
I think there's other manufacturers of bottles, but I haven't seen them. Mm-hmm. There was got one at a convention from somebody in South America, and I didn't like the material because of the type of moldings.
The Chinese were making them.
And then their Chinese are making them, so it's all over.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I was talking with Fantasio at Jacksonville at the IBM convention recently about his appearing canes and about how that had gone up and down and the reason that it went down. I mean, he had his own manufacturing company and everybody working for him, and then it went down because of the cheaper made ones in China.
Sad.
And he said, I can't compete with that.
Right.
And so, you know, they're selling
and
of it.
There's
so
no way you could compete with the Chinese. I think I had a conversation with George Robinson from Viking that went to China, and he says it was scary because he went into a factory, and it was probably, I don't know, 10,000 square feet or more of space, and each area in that company had areas where they were only making zigzags.
Wow.
And there was another area where they were only making canes.
Huh.
And, I mean, it was thousands.
Just cranking them out.
Yeah. Cranking them out. And and everybody was like little minions, you know, working all over the factory floor. And it was all this magic made out very cheaply, partly because the cost of the materials and the labor is cheaper, and probably from the government subsidies that other factories get in China.
Well, obviously that discourages creativity and inventiveness because a lot of the guys, I mean, like John Cornelius, it's like, stop making stuff. It's like, if this is going to get ripped off and I'm not going to be able to get, you know, funded for my research and development and be recognized for this, then I'm not going to make anything else. You know.
So we don't know where, I think it's too early to tell where that trend will eventually take us in the next 50 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think everything is moving online, and the people that create magic is the one trick DVD.
Right.
Of guys that they created, get a little money up front, and then you assume that it's going to...
Well, that's got to be the way also with music, that they've gone, of course, from albums to CDs and everything, in which that it used to be that they would have one or two good songs on the record, mm-hmm. and then they started releasing just the one song, and then they can download them from iTunes or whatever. And I was at a party with some other entertainers, and I was the only magician. The rest of them are all professional musicians, and they now have business cards that are basically small CDs. So this way, like, this is my song I'm handing out, so you can take and pop their CD or their business card into your computer, and they'll play their song. Wow. And that's usually like their best playing song. I mean, but it's their promotion. It's a good way of promoting yourself, I thought, then, too.
And now, not even that. Look at Magic Live. All the lecture notes
are online.
So all you do is send people a password.
Well, that's true. Of course, Stan was saying that the password that each person is given is unique to them. I guess they can probably go back and see if there are too many downloads of one that someone obviously has given this out. He's telling you, listen, you've paid for this. Why should you give something to someone when you've paid $300 or more for the thing? And which is another thing, I kind of like the idea that he did not release this online until after the convention. So this way, people spent more time interacting with each other, which I think this is what the convention was a lot about, spending time with friends and talking rather than pouring through the notes or whatever, you know. And so you've been in Las Vegas then, because you live in L.A., but have you been in Vegas now for 20 years or
20
so?
20 years, 27 years.
And Mark, 22.
20 years, And, I mean, this is very comfortable home, I mean, that where you live, and you have your printer, I guess, upstairs and everything that you make, and the workshop out back, and the pool in between. You can kind of relax from time to time.
I was living in L.A. I had a nice home there, doing fine, and Peter Ravine came over one day, and he says, I want to show you a place in Las Vegas. And he brought me here. We look at this house, and I just said, this is perfect. Mm-hmm. With the little building over the museum and the workshop, everything I would ever want, you know. I said, let's go to the realtor's office.
Right there, huh?
Right then and there. And the following day, they came over, and I remember I said, how much is the whole thing going to be? Because I saw the workshop. And they gave me the price. I said, where do I sign?
Yeah, it's a good deal.
I had a check in my hand.
Now, you work with Peter Ravine, speaking of him, and others from time to time.
Peter.
Do you have any stories about Peter?
Oh, there's a lot of stories about Peter. I probably shouldn't go into too many of those. Lupe, did you see Coral last night?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you did? Oh, I didn't see her.
That's his widow, right?
Yeah.
At the bar? Not at the bar, at the Japanese place.
Oh, yeah?
She was there, and...
She didn't even say anything. I thought she was going to be there. I talked to Ty, her son, their son.
I remember seeing or reading about the birthday party they had, in which the Jeff Hobson had done a parody, I guess, and he dressed up like the movie, you know, whatever.
Yeah, making up for it.
It was a fun event. Well, what I mean, you've worked around the world and performed everything, and then kind of retired your act some years ago, and then decided that I'm going to be working then with just building and creating.
Well,
sort of things.
You know, I got to the point where how could I stay in shape for doing cards and stuff?
Sure.
And then for 2 weeks I'm out in the workshop using lacquer thinners and stuff on my hands and. I couldn't do the cards well.
Yeah.
You know, so I had to make a decision.
One or the other.
Yeah.
And you decided that this was more of a passion at this point in your life.
I was ready, exactly.
Yeah.
I love working in the workshop.
Yeah.
Just as I love walking on stage and doing an act.
You have to be awfully careful, because I'm thinking of Paul Daniels, you know, working in his workshop and cut off a finger. I know it bothered him for the longest time. You really have to be very cautious.
Oh, I think about it every time I turn the table saw on.
Yeah. Have you been training anybody else or encouraging people? I mean, just like that you were inspired by Aikido and you had made something and brought to him. Have people ever made something and come to you, or you've shared some things?
No, I've never had any. I've had people ask me, you know, they wanted to
train under you or something.
Yeah,
but you really have
quite a craft.
Well, I know I mean, my gosh, I mean, the tables and stuff you're making. You're posting these things on.
Yeah,
that is an awesome table.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I see those things on Facebook. You're showing the different things you're turning or the or whatever. It's like that is beautiful. Yeah, you're doing fantastic work. And so, but this doesn't count, Norm, as far as training her. I mean, but I was wondering. No, not right now.
Okay.
Thank you very much. But I was just thinking about other people who I look for an example, like at Jeff McBride and some others who are training other magicians, you know, the next generation and going on like that. And I'm sure you've had a lot of people who have come to ask you for that. But there hasn't really been anybody you have taken under your wing or trained.
I had one student when I was in L.A., and he died young. Sven Gehry. Paul Sven Gehry was his name. He was from northern Wisconsin. Nice kid, tall kid. And
yeah.
He loved it. I think I still have a video of him.
Yeah.
But,
well, do you recommend people still attending the Chavez classes? And
oh, absolutely. Sure.
Okay.
Marvelous.
I just didn't know if that was necessarily dated or not, because I see the people from South Korea and, you know, some of the Asians that have these beautiful acts that that are a little bit Chavez-like, because they seem to be a little bit cookie-cutter, kind of, the way they strike poses and a little tableau kind of a thing.
When I finished Chavez, I went around to the agents in L.A. trying to get work. And they said, oh, you were a Chavez student. And they knew all the key moves that Chavez did it. I thought, oh, my God. And from that moment on, I had to try to change it and make something more original.
Yeah, which you did, obviously, from there. And wasn't that like, it wasn't an online class. I mean, of course it wasn't online back then.
No.
But I meant to say, it wasn't a something you had taken, like, and read from the book. You actually were taking it from
Betty and Marion.
Yeah.
And I loved it. I liked Marion, too, but I wanted to learn from Benny, because he was masculine and so forth. I don't mean the one from England, but anyway, it was great. And Marion, great performer, you know.
And that was carried on then, of course, by Dale Selwick now, but I'm trying to think that to follow out. Neil Foster, thank you.
Neil
Foster was doing that.
That's right.
And aside from Dale, are there any other people who are teaching the class? Do you know David or Norm?
There's another name, but I can't think of it right now.
I think they're in Wisconsin or something.
I don't know where he is.
Yeah, I forget his name. Yeah.
But someone is authorized to
to
do the class.
Yeah.
I don't know what authorization he had, but I do remember that years ago. Yeah.
I recall.
Magicians teaching the Chavez course. Bill Sawick, which is a better known.
Yeah.
And there's somebody, I think, in the Midwest.
Well,
I'm not sure.
Oh, yeah. I just can't remember the name.
Right.
Yeah.
What I recall was that there was a manual. I guess I wasn't trying to say online a while ago, but there was a manual, because there was a fella in San Antonio who had taken the Chavez class, and then he was selling these manuals. And I guess he received a letter saying, again, this was well before email or whatever, and saying that you're not authorized because you signed an agreement saying this is just for me, and I'm not going to pass these on to anybody else. And if they wanted to learn, they have to take the class. You can't buy it secondhand from, is that right?
Right.
Yeah, okay. So that's why I was wondering whether that, and so he took the class actually kind of as a mail order. That's what I'm trying to say. Not online, but a mail order. Boy, that was a long time ago also. It's kind of like the Harlan Tarbell. That started out as a mail order class, I think, also. Did you know Harlan Tarbell by chance?
I only saw him lecture once.
Mm-hmm.
That was all in Chicago.
Yeah.
I didn't really know him. I was just a little punk kid, you know.
You've known a lot of magicians, legendary throughout the years, and worked with many of them. Some come to mind?
Channing Pollock. Channing was a dream. He was just such a great human being.
A real gentleman, the times I've met him.
He sure was,
nice.
And we hung out together. And if I had an idea, I'd call him, and he says, let me think about that. You call back 2 days later. That won't work in this town. And you give me all the reasons why.
Yeah.
he was wonderful.
And he was on the Ed Sullivan Show, I believe, a time or two. And you performed there as well? On Ed Sullivan?
I was on once,
Once, okay. I was going to say, it seems like I recall, David, didn't we have an IBM convention once in which we had several people who had been performers on the on Ed Sullivan over the years, you know, John Mooring and some other guys. And
Chang.
Who's that?
Chang.
Okay. Chang. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Albert Chang. Was it Chang or Chang?
I think it was Chang.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the most famous one was Fred Capps, who was a magician, worked on the same night as the Beatles were there. He was like the warm-up act for the Beatles or something, you know. Because you mentioned Letty, what's his name?
Mark Letty.
Yeah, who was the producer, I guess. The booker for that show.
I did a television in Holland.
Mm-hmm.
And at the studio, who comes in but Fred Capps?
Oh.
He heard I was going to be there.
Yeah.
We met, and that was just, I was thrilled. So he took me home with him afterward. I had such good luck that way. I remember meeting Del Odell like that.
Yeah.
We worked on a show together. She took me, asked me if I'd like to come to her home.
Mm-hmm.
And I met Charlie, and it was just a thrill, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. I met Senior Wences once, who was at the Magic Castle. I was working in the close-up room. I remember him coming in,
mm-hmm.
and then later he had a reception. Went to visit with him, and that was just a thrill to meet somebody like that.
Oh yeah, yeah. We were good pals, you know.
Were you?
Oh yeah,
mm-hmm.
yeah. In L.A., they came over to the house. Tully, his wife, and I were really close. She mm-hmm. she wrote me all the time.
Oh, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I knew what was going on, where they were working, and so forth.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Channing Pollock was wonderful, and a lot of other guys. Did you work very much with some of the guys, like Tommy Cooper? I'm thinking of guys from England, you know, that were over there. And
I don't know Tommy. I've only seen him work.
Okay, you never met him?
No.
Or anything?
Never.
I just wondered if your European travels, if they had been around, you know, then.
Yeah. I never met him.
Hmm. Well, listen, as we start to kind of wrap up, and I want to go through and take a stroll over to the museum here then as well. So,
nothing to see in the museum.
Not too much because you've moved everything, all the big stuff, over to Chicago.
Yeah.
This is much more than there.
Over here. Mm-hmm. But I was going to say to wrap up that the name of my podcast is called the Magic Word Podcast. And so let me ask you, what is your magic word? And I don't mean this sort of like abracadabra. What's important? What's your philosophy of life?
Oh,
it could be a sentence or a phrase or something that's important.
Boy.
Lupe, you'd be thinking about that then, too.
Do unto others as you have them do unto you.
That's good, too. That's good.
Yeah. Or do unto others before they do unto you. Yeah.
But I always like to hear some wisdom as to, you know, what it is that makes this person tick so that way that you know that...
Yeah. You never know. Everybody you meet, you know, there's a new personality.
Yeah.
And some people you meet, oh my God, you feel like you know them already, you know.
Yeah.
And others, you know, you just have to walk away.
So, no one to hold them, no one to fold them.
Yeah.
I guess.
That's it.
Lupe, any comment?
Well, basically, I'm more into the manufacturing part of magic. So, lately, in the last few years, I admire a lot of the Shaker community at the turn of the century in the United States. They always had a saying where they said that make your work or whatever you create it to last over 1,000 years, and work today as if today was the last day of your life. So that was how the excellence that they had in.
I'm getting tired.
They try to achieve that every day. Because we don't know how long we're going to be here.
No.
That's true. Mm-hmm. And their furniture was beautiful and functional and does last. I've seen a museum of Shaker furniture, and they talk about that's quite interesting. Well, listen, I thank you guys so very much, you know, for opening your home also giving us stories and talking about that, all this. And so. Thank you guys very much, and thank you to the studio audience over there.
Yeah.
David, for being here then, too. So, that was Norm and Lupe Nielsen for the Magic Word Podcast. This is Scotty out.
What a fascinating couple, and such wonderful stories. I regret that you were not along with me to see their beautiful home, but I did post some photos, along with a video, on the blog at themagicwordpodcast.com. I encourage you to visit and view the picture gallery. I also posted photos I took the last time in 2007 when I was in his home, when his collection was intact. My friend Dick Olson was with me at the time and in several of the pictures. Now, as promised, enjoy a true tale about the legendary Kansas City magician, Fawcett Ross, as told by his young friend, David Sandy.
All right. I want to add an addendum over here, because since I have David Sandy with me, that I want him to share a story about Fawcett Ross that I think you guys haven't heard, but I think you might enjoy, that I've heard him tell before. So I'm going to let you hold the ball, hold the microphone. You can tell the story.
All right. Well, first of all, it's a pleasure to be here at the Nielsen's home, seeing beautiful posters. And
yeah,
now we're talking in the workshop, so this is a lot of fun. And I, as an addendum to the Norm Nielsen interview, I should say that the first convention I ever produced was in honor of my mentor, Fawcett Ross. Mm-hmm. I was 18 at the time, and I brought in performers. As a farm kid, my only connection to the magic world was through Genie magazine. Mm-hmm. And so I brought in performers for that convention that I had read about and idolized in the pages of Genie magazine,
right.
And Norm Nielsen was one of those guys. Mm-hmm. And so we had, you know, on one show alone, Norm Nielsen, Marvin and Carol Roy, Slidini, Shimada. It was just an incredible show. And I can say that the gentleman you would see on stage floating the violin and making the flute disappear and all of these wonderful things and the musical magic of Norm Nielsen, that gentleman, that persona, is the man that you, in real life, he's one of the kindest,
nicest,
he's just mm-hmm. a gentleman through and through.
Yeah.
So that was a very much a pleasure to work with Norm, because when you're 18 and you're bringing in people, you know,
legend
of this stature,
yes, yeah,
you know, it's a little bit intimidating, but Norm was wonderful to work with. So
David, I will pay you that money back.
Yes. But anyway, the Norm, or the Fawcett Ross story, you know, I took care of Fawcett up until the time he passed away in 1987. And I would visit Fawcett, you know, I met Fawcett when I was about 13 or 14. And as I got older and old enough to drive, I would drive to St. Joe every weekend to visit Fawcett and take him to the store. And I was very lucky, because when Fawcett's friends would come and visit, they would stay with me because I had an extra bedroom when I was in college going there in St. Joseph, Missouri. So I had house guests such as the professor, Ross and Helen Bertram. Charlie Miller came in to stay a few nights, and ended up 2.5 months later, he's still there. In fact, interesting about Charlie, America's Guest.
Yeah, I've heard that.
At one point, I was moving to another apartment while Charlie was staying with me, and as I was looking for places, Charlie would walk in with me, and he'd look around, not good. You know, so he had a big influence on my next
decision.
Apartment. But anyway, Fawcett, as I would visit him, he had a cat named Tuffy, and Tuffy was his pride and joy, and Tuffy was a very discriminating cat when it came to magic and magicians, because if she didn't like your magic, she would go in the other room and get under the bed. But Fawcett would frequently tell me, as I would sit on the floor, you know, and Fawcett would teach me things, that Tuffy was his companion, and it was his final wish that when he passed, that he be buried with Tuffy.
Mm-hmm.
And I would hear this time and time again, you know, he would repeat this over the years. And I had graduated college, I was working as a director at the local TV station, and I got a call from the cleaning lady that would go in and clean Fawcett's apartment with the unfortunate news that she had gone in and found that Fawcett had passed away.
Mm-hmm.
So I, along with a cousin of Fawcett's, Mary Ferris, had the responsibility making the arrangements, you know, for Fawcett's funeral. So called the funeral home, and as is traditional with magicians, often as a part of the service, there's a broken wand ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we got the first stage of getting all the funeral planning, and then we decided we should do the broken wand. So I called the funeral director, and I said, you know, as a part of this service, we would like to do a broken wand ceremony, which he was a little bit hesitant on this, because he thought, you know, this sounded a little bit
black magic,
the occult, or something like that. I assured him it's just symbolic, you know, a wooden wand is broken, signifying, you know, the end of this performer's magic.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, then so I crossed that hurdle of getting the broken wand ceremony arranged for the service, and then Mary called me and said, David, did Fawcett ever mention to you his last wish, his request? And I said, are you speaking about Tuffy? She goes, yes. And I said, well, of course, you know, he mentioned it many, many times. And she said, well, I think that's the only he asked for. I think that's what we need to do. And my response was, but Mary, Tuffy's still alive.
Yeah.
Well, this is where you're going to start getting letters from folks.
PETA.
But I said, Mary felt very strongly that, you know, this needed to be done, and I'm starting to have second thoughts about telling this story. Although I've told it at many
times. It's going to be online forever.
Yeah, I know. So anyway, Mary said, I had a key to Fawcett's apartment. Mary said, I have a friend, Doc, will meet us at the apartment tonight at 10 o'clock, and Doc will take care of things. This was the night before the funeral. You make the arrangements with the funeral home and meet us there at Fawcett's apartment at 10 o'clock tonight. He owned a big house that was divided in multiple apartments. He actually owned the place. But anyway, so that was the plan, and I assume her friend Doc, who I assumed was a veterinarian, was going to put Tuffy to sleep.
Not just a title like Doc Eason.
No. So anyway, at this point I had to call the funeral director back and say there's another layer that we need to add to this. Beyond the broken wand ceremony, Fawcett's request was to be buried with his cat, a companion.
It's familiar,
cat.
Like most warlocks are. You know?
Well, anyway, so that was a bigger hurdle,
to
get past. But finally, he said, "Well, we can do that. The cat can be inside the vault, but not inside the casket."
Okay.
And so, 10 o'clock comes. I swing by 7-Eleven and pick up one of those styrofoam ice chest things.
Mm-hmm.
In preparation, I was going to leave it there and then the next morning go by and get ice and put Tuffy on ice so I could take it to the funeral home to the service.
Okay.
So anyway, I'm there at 10 o'clock standing. Fawcett's house was up on quite an incline up off the street with these old broken concrete steps that went up. It was, a little bit intimidating. He had one of those yellow bug lights, repellent lights on the front porch. So there's this eerie yellow light. I'm standing on the front porch waiting for Mary and Doc to show up.
Mm-hmm.
And Tuffy is inside the house. I'm just standing on the porch waiting, and car pulls up in the darkness, and two figures get out of the car and make their way up the steps. It's Mary.
It's like The Exorcist, sounds like.
it's Mary, and
okay.
I can see a figure behind her who I'm assuming is Doc. And so they get up to the front porch, and I said to Mary, she introduces me, David, this is Doc, and I said, nice to meet you. I assume that, this will be very humane and appropriate, and you'll, do an injection or something like this? And he said, yes, you could say that. And he had a .22 rifle with him.
Okay.
And at that point, I said, I don't want to know anything. I just want to remove myself from this situation.
Yeah.
Just put the cat in this bag in the freezer, and I'll swing by the next morning pick him up with the ice chest. And so one time I was telling this story to a friend, and she interrupted me, and she goes, oh, my gosh, you didn't bury him with a pot roast, did you? That would be a completely different twist on the story, but that's not what happened.
Yeah.
Anyway, moving on, the next day I swing by about an hour before the service. I go in, got the ice in the ice chest, go to the freezer, open up the freezer door. There's the hefty bag in there, kind of bundled up. I kind of feel at it, and I can feel, the substance. The
outline of the body.
Right, yeah. I mean, I didn't go to much detail, but I...
It wasn't a see-through bag.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Put the bag and its contents in the ice chest, and I'm off to the funeral home. And I thought it would be kind of nice. I had a bag that I used in my act for many years that was, like an oversized cloth bag. And I also had a piece of rope that I used in my rope tie, and so I thought this would be a nice velvet bag, for mm-hmm. Tuffy to be placed in, and that would, because Fawcett was so meaningful to me,
a
little bit of me,
sure,
would kind of be a part of this, too. So anyway, the service goes very well. We go out to the cemetery for the burial, and as everyone kind of leaves, the funeral director, closes the casket, and the bag, Tuffy, is laid on top of the casket inside the vault,
the vault,
and everything goes into the ground. So about 4 or 5 days later, I get a call from a magician friend of mine who worked with a lady that lived across the street from Fawcett. And he said, so Nellie said to me at work, what are you going to do with a cat? She sees Tuffy scratching at Fawcett's door every night. Is someone feeding the cat? And I'm thinking, wait a minute. This is, you mean Tuffy has been spotted? Well, so I immediately call Mary and I say, Mary, I think we have a problem. Tuffy is apparently in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And she says, don't say anything. I'll take care of it.
Yeah.
So that's all I knew about that. But as I backtrack this, knowing Fawcett and visiting Fawcett many times, there was an alley cat that sometimes Fawcett in his older age would move quite slowly when he would go in and out of his apartment. Mm-hmm. The front door, you know, he'd open it. And this cat, this alley cat, would run between his legs, go in, eat Tuffy's food, and then Fawcett would spend the next half a day trying to get this cat he despised out, you know. So, you know, I guess, you know, we draw the conclusions that at some point in when Fawcett was removed from the apartment and people were going in and out, that perhaps this alley cat had darted its way in. And when I just unlocked the door when Doc and Mary showed up, and Doc goes in, sees a cat, expires the cat, wraps the cat into a bag, goes into the freezer. I never checked.
Sure.
And so, unfortunately, we can only assume that despite Fawcett's request, he is actually buried with a cat he despised. And so, I don't know what happened to Tuffy, but Mary said she would take care of it, so I assume that she did. So I have this fear of when my time comes and I make it to the pearly gates, Fawcett is going to be standing there drumming his fingers with a mighty bone to pick with me. So,
well, that alley cat got its just desserts. So I guess finally.
So,
holy cow.
Anyway, that's the Fawcett Tuffy story.
Cat. Not the holy cat. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Nice little coda there at the ending. All right.
That's a great story.
Yeah. Well, I think, didn't Matt King say it was his favorite story?
Matt King says that's his favorite story. In fact, several years ago at Magic Live, you know, he had this late night campfire story thing, and he had me tell
that story. Yeah.
You know?
That's a good one. That's good.
Any letters should be directed to Scott Wells at the Magic Word Podcast.
Yeah, that's the wrong address, so that's good. So use that one. Thank you guys very much. Thanks, David.
Thanks for sharing the story.
Yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah.
For the Magic Word Podcast, that's Scotty out.
Thank you, David, for that story, and thank you, Lupe and Norm, for opening your home and your hearts and sharing your stories. I hope you enjoyed hearing these stories and perhaps learning a little history from a true legend. And thank you for listening, following, subscribing, and donating to the Magic Word Podcast. And speaking of donating, I recently received an audio email from John Grabiel, who is a longtime supporter and member of the Friends of the Magic Word. I'm always interested in knowing what my listeners like and what makes this podcast worth pledging donations. Well, here's what John has to say.
I'm John Grabiel, and I'm a friend of the Magic Word. I would like to thank Scott for taking the time that he does to put this podcast together and to bring everything that's going on in the magic world home to me. When I'm listening to it, I feel as though I am there, whether it's FISM, the IBM convention, or Magic Live. I'm also a financial supporter of the podcast and a patron. I encourage all the listeners to financially support Scott so that he can continue this great podcast. Thanks again, Scott.
Thank you, John, for your kind words of encouragement and your support of the Magic Word with your ongoing financial pledge. I hope your words will help motivate others to think what these podcasts mean to them and find it worthy of their patronage, too. Your support, suggestions, and friendship is what keeps this podcast on the air, and I appreciate every one of you listening, subscribing, and following us each week. And speaking of being on the air, there will not be a podcast posted next Thursday. But don't worry, because you'll get your fill of the Magic Word beginning a couple days later, because I will be traveling to Austin, Texas, and posting daily updates from the Texas Association of Magicians Convention commencing Saturday, September the 5th. So, until next time, stay well, get booked, and go out and read a book on magic history. This is Scotty out.